You may be seated.
Thank you.
The next case before the court is Appeal Number 30814, Trigger Energy Holdings et al. Versus Kent Stevens et al. Daniel Brentrow is present on behalf of the plaintiff appellants, and Matthew McIntosh is present arguing on behalf of the defendant appellees. Each side will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and then Mr. Brentrow, you'll get a five-minute rebuttal, and you can proceed.
May it please the court, counsel, Mr. Chief Justice. The good news and the bad news about this case is that it operates under the shadow of Dunes Hospitality. The good news is that we know the cause of action exists. We know that it has elements. I think we can clean those up with this opinion. But the bad news is that that case is being used in tension as a rules case and as a results case, depending on who's doing the talking.
So if you were going to clean up the rules from the Country Kitchen case, how would you clean them up?
Pages 17 and 18 of our brief is about as concise as you can make it. If you take the elements and just explain them in two or three words, that's what page 17 does. Page 18 then explains, using language from Dakota Dunes or Dunes Hospitality, what the phrases are that attach to each of the elements. What tended to happen in that opinion, along with almost every attempt since by other courts to use that, is that phrases get borrowed from one element and used in the wrong element, and it confuses the whole process. The simplest element is, and ultimately these three elements are really all jury questions, and they're designed that way. And so using Dunes Hospitality as a factual model to say, oh, this is not duress, or it is an inappropriate use of the case, because it gives us the test and it tells us it's a jury question, or the types of things that are jury questions. The first element, was it involuntary? And the Alaska cases show us that this is a subjective test. I think there's no better example of how involuntariness is a subjective process than that the two plaintiffs in this case arrived at their involuntariness at separate times based upon separate facts. Trigger, right away, was succumbing to the threats. Gulf Coast, it took a while for them to come around and realize that this was a serious threat. That's a subjective inquiry. It's not the type of thing that is amenable to summary judgment. Almost any case like that where you're asking about whether something was voluntary or involuntary, what the state of mind was of the person receiving a particular set of conduct, that's a jury question. And as far as summary judgment would go, as long as they're testifying that this was subjectively involuntary, that's sufficient. A jury can later disbelieve them. A jury can attach other objective evidence and decide that that doesn't make any sense, that it was involuntary, it wasn't reasonable. But that's the first element. That's an easy one. And as long as you focus just on the language, that one we can move on from, because it's clear in almost all of these cases. Any meaningful plaintiff that's bringing a duress case probably has some level of subjective involuntariness.
So, but isn't there some objectivity to that determination if you're looking at involuntariness from the standpoint? It's got to be a situation, you know, it's easy for somebody to come in and say, yeah, oh, you know what, I didn't really agree to this. I felt like I had to do this. I mean,
yeah.
That's not enough, clearly.
It's depending on the circumstances. And the last case is actually, there's one of them that even says
that. Yeah, and it's more objective when you start to look at the circumstances, right?
It would be both. It's a subjective, did the person subjectively feel threatened? And then the Alaska test suggests that you would look at their subjective statements with regard to the objective circumstances. And so there's that process. The second element, reasonable alternatives, is like right down the middle of the plate for what juries do. And if you think about each one of these phrases, was it mere acquiescence? I'm sorry, that's the first element. I was going to point that out. If you get to reluctance, the idea of reluctance versus involuntary, or mere acquiescence to involuntary, It's a continuum, and at some point you cross the line involuntary, and that's what the jury would do, is decide, is this just acquiescence?
You know, the Alaska cases, and some of the cases actually that we cite in Dunes Hospitality, in their formulation of that second prong, they don't say reasonable. They just say you didn't have a choice. And maybe they cover some objective component. I'm trying to recall them now, but I thought that was interesting. When we recapitulated and restated those elements in Dunes Hospitality, our formulation includes reasonable. And I mention that because economic duress is an outgrowth of duress and the broader doctrine and the general principles that relate to duress. A party is deprived of their volition. They have no opportunity. They have no choice. And in this case, and in this type of tort, they're under some financial strain or constraints that the other party is in part, at least, responsible for. When the undisputed material facts, when considered and drawn in a light most favorably to the non-moving party, say what they say, why couldn't be summary judgment, not even this case, why couldn't summary judgment or judgment as a matter of law, if it was the case in Dunes Hospitality, why wouldn't that be appropriate?
In this case or any case?
Any case.
Well, it would be in some cases.
So what makes this one different? What are the disputed material facts, or what prevents under Rule 56 the entry of a judgment as a matter of law? So, as a backdrop to this, I'll throw this out there as well, just as something that sort of I think is rattling around. Courts probably, although they don't always say it, have an institutional aversion to intervening in what is otherwise a private agreement negotiated by parties at arm's length. And only when it seems as though the courts must intervene in order to prevent the deprivation of someone's volition or some sort of compulsory overreaching would they intervene. So why is this that kind of a case?
So the elements one by one, I think subjectively both parties come to this conclusion that they have no other choice. The objectivity, Chief Justice, is that second element, are there reasonable alternatives? So you're sort of evaluating their subjective belief of involuntariness against the availability, with an objective test, of reasonable alternatives. The circuit court erred by saying that, well, they talked about the idea that they could sue. They had a list of five choices from their attorney, so therefore they had options. That's not the test. The test is if they're adequate, if they're reasonable, adequate, would work.
And you think a jury makes that decision?
Yes, and that's the adequacy of remedies, reasonableness of choices, an objective test. That's a jury that makes that decision.
During Mr. Keogh's deposition, he acknowledged, I could have just walked away. How about that? Would that have been an opportunity to just say, we're not going to do this deal?
I think that was presented to them too, but it was not feasible.
Why not? Blueprint had turned the corner, was now making money, was servicing the debt to Aladdin Capital. No indication, as I can see, although Mr. Keogh was very concerned about the debt because Aladdin Capital was borrowing to extend credit to Blueprint. But it's paying. It's finally turned its corner. Stevens and Keogh don't like each other, but why can't he walk away? And he says it, so that's his testimony. Why isn't that an option?
I guess in the context of all this, it wasn't a meaningful option.
Because he didn't want to work with Stevens, but is that coercion?
And I guess maybe I don't understand what you mean by walk away or what Scott meant by walk away. But
he doesn't sell.
I mean, he just stays there as a co-partner.
Yes.
Yeah, well, and I think Kent is saying, sell it to me or I'm leaving. That's the threat. I don't think there's an option where Kent stays and Scott stay in the same company.
I don't know that I read it that way, and I'm willing to be corrected. But what I understood the dynamite option to be was, sell it to me at $800,000. Do not negotiate this price or I blow the thing up. at least in the light most favorable to you as the your clients as the non-moving party. I didn't see something in there where Stephen said, leave, or I blow this place up.
So we may be cutting hairs here, but sell me your shares, or else I'll exact my threat is a leaving by asking you to leave by a different term. I mean,
so I didn't see that. And maybe I'm wrong. I did not see that. I saw it relating to the price. I thought that's where this litigation was focused, was on the $800,000 price. I get my number, which is different than Kios, and you don't talk about it. And if you hassle me about it, I'm taking the troops. I'm leaving. You're on your own. I did not see that threat made relative to the acquisition of the equity interests themselves. But I could be wrong, and I'm willing to be corrected in that regard.
And maybe that's what a jury is for, is if you're seeing it that way. I had never contemplated that view of the facts until this moment. And so if you and I are seeing it differently.
Well, Keogh testified to it.
Yeah, but what did he mean by that? I've never taken that piece of testimony to mean what you're attributing it to.
Okay.
So it was a hostage situation by any other words. What I think is most critical, you've got Dunes Hospitality, which as a matter of law says there's no case here, which complicates things because suddenly it looks like it's really hard to accomplish this. But the answer in that case, and it took years for us to finally notice it, paragraph 32, in which Justice Sabers points out that of the numerous sophisticated members of its LLC, a law professor, two lawyers, two doctors, and a real estate broker, what he says is several of them were urging not to sign this document that they're later challenging. Several of them were urging to terminate Country Kitchen's management contract, and several of them were urging to initiate a lawsuit immediately. And Justice Sabers uses that as proof that multiple members of your LLC found that to be a reasonable course of action. That's the difference. Here, sophisticated businessmen arrived at the conclusion at separate points in time that these were not reasonable options. Trigger is saying right away, there's no other option here. We better do this or else it's gonna get bad. Scott Keogh doesn't believe it. It takes him weeks to finally come around to the idea that this is serious. And then at that point, you have zero members of this LLC saying, let's go along with this number because it's a good idea, as opposed to let's go along with it because it's duress. So paragraph 32 is how you distinguish these cases if you need to. When you get to the third element, whether it's coercive, wrongful act, and then the causal link, Dunes Hospitality says that you've got tortious conduct and criminal conduct, which are included, but it doesn't limit it to that. It would be obvious that there is some degree of analysis that has to take place, because criminal conduct would include speeding 6 miles over the speed limit. I was driving in a car and he was speeding 6 miles over and threatening to do these things or else he was going to keep driving 6 miles an hour over. Well, that's criminal, but it's not enough of a wrongful conduct. When you look at it in a larger context, though, what it is a relationship test. There are certain things that are allowed by certain people and certain things that we surrender our rights to. When you get a law license, you surrender some of your rights to do things the way you did before you had a law license. As you'll hear in the next hour, when you start a trucking company, you surrender some of your rights about how you operate your business. There are standards and rules that apply to you. When you become a fiduciary of a company or a shareholder in a closely held entity, you've surrendered by statute, by common law, some of your rights. When you start selling insurance and processing claims, you surrender some of your rights to go about the process of this arm's length contracting process. And so that third element is a qualitative element. I think that one, in certain cases, Justice Alter, would lend itself to summary judgment, that it's not wrongful enough, that no reasonable jury could find that. When you've got disputed facts and a set of circumstances where, as a matter of law, somebody has fiduciary duties to an entity and can't do certain things, that summary judgment's not going to happen. The notion that Kent could just quit his job, that he had the freedom to do that, it's a red herring. He's not just saying he's quitting his job. It's a multi-prong threat. I'm gonna quit. I'm gonna steal all the customers. I'm gonna set up shop across town and compete, breaching my non-solicitation, breaching my non-compete, and I'm gonna do it in a fashion that he has a name for it. It's the dynamite option.
So you think that what? So your theory on this is that Stevens has a fiduciary duty that he owes to the other personally, that he owes to the other members, the principals of the other members, or to
so
what?
I have 20 seconds, and the answer does not lend itself to 20 seconds. But we detail in the brief all of the different portions of the limited liability model act that would trigger statutory responsibilities for somebody in his position.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you brought that up because those fiduciary duties are different. Whether they exist at all is different depending upon whether the limited liability company is a member-managed company, this is not one, or whether it is a manager-managed company, this is one.
Yes.
And so as I read 409 of that act that's been enacted, I'm having a hard time seeing the existence of a fiduciary duty owed among the members in a manager-managed company. Loudon, of course, here, a non-member was designated as the manager.
There's another statute, and I can't tell you exactly where it is in the brief, that says that a manager in a manager-managed company would owe those duties.
Stevens is not a manager.
He conceded that he was at his deposition.
Well, maybe in a generic sense, but under the Uniform Act that we've enacted, the composition of this limited liability company is, as I read the operating agreement, a manager-managed, the manager being not Stevens, but Aladdin, because Aladdin's designated as being the manager. Stevens may run day-to-day, may have management sort of responsibilities, but I'm questioning, and I'll certainly listen to your answer, but I'm questioning whether he's the manager intended to be the manager and manager-managed. A lot of managers there. I'm sorry.
It's a fair question, and I'm over time, so I'm answering a question way beyond time now. But
you can answer
I'm
that
sorry,
question.
Yeah.
If the entity has apportioned the responsibilities and the duties, and he is an officer of the company, and he admits that he's an officer, whether it's by statute or by common law, and his own admission that he owed several duties to the entity and to his partners, the facts would suggest that that's what everybody thought it was. He wasn't surprised to get these questions. He answered them in a way that suggested that he was aware that he had these responsibilities. He didn't. You know, nothing has happened since then where he attempted to deny that. Ultimately, you get back to this question in Dunes Hospitality. This doctrine is for a special, unusual, extraordinary case. This is that case. I've never heard of such a thing. Somebody taking actions like this, making threats like this. But we don't win because it's special, unusual, extraordinary. We win because each of those elements can be met one at a time. And it's a jury question. That's
your
that's
your time's up, Mr. Brentrell.
Thank you.
Mr. McIntosh, you can proceed.
Thank you, Chief Justice Jensen. My name is Matt McIntosh. May it please the court, counsel. I represent the appellees in this matter, and we are here on the appeal of the lower court's order granting our motion for summary judgment. That's an order that this court reviews de novo. And before I begin the legal analysis, I'd like to set forth some facts that are vital to understanding the transaction that occurred here. First, we have two competent attorneys, one on each side of this transaction. We have three sophisticated businessmen, all in equal shares of ownership of a company called Blueprint Energy Partners, LLC. We have exchanges over a period of months that included drafts and redrafts between parties through their attorneys, which resulted in four fully executed documents to effectuate the sales of the interests from the appellants to the appellee TCU. This included a letter of intent and 50 days later, a membership interest purchase agreement that were identical for both appellants in this case. There were payments made of $800,000, one to Scott Keogh on behalf of his company, Gulf Coast, $800,000 paid to Waylon Geike on behalf of his company, Trigger Energy, and then over $3.2 million paid to Aladdin Capital, who shares the same ownership as Gulf Coast.
Mr. McIntosh,
yes, sir.
Can I jump in there? So would it be fair to regard that aspect, that latter one, of this transaction as being something that's really beyond, strictly speaking, the equity buyout, right? So you could want one member could buy out another member or two, whatever, without taking out the lender, right?
Yes.
The lender here, however, was Aladdin. Aladdin's closely aligned with Gulf Coast, and Mr. Keogh's principal in both of those. And the record's very clear that he was nervous about getting paid. So am I right in thinking, I mean, that was part, this wasn't strictly an equity buyout, I guess, because they're also taking out this related lender, and that was negotiated between these lawyers that you're describing?
Correct, Your Honor. That's correct. That was a concern, and it was part of the negotiation process because Gulf Coast and Aladdin Capital are one and the same. Scott Keogh was negotiating, and part of the negotiation process included, and the testimony from Attorney John Mullen was, there was a negotiation of, we want a price true up, and then there was, we are not going to agree to that. So then the return was, we will drop the price true up if you agree to these things. Those things included a non-disclosure agreement, tax implications, and first position for Aladdin Capital so that they could maintain on the accounts receivable, which was to occur after the conclusion.
On the factoring, Atlanta, which is, and that's, I understand, a different Aladdin entity. Aladdin Capital is the lender, but I think it's Aladdin Financial maybe is the factoring. That actually carried through for a short period of time. There's a little bit of run out on that.
Correct.
So, but I was just thinking, I mean, if you're gonna buy someone out, that's fine. But this was a little more than that, seems like. But maybe I'm wrong.
No, I think you're exactly correct. And it's part of the reason that Scott Keogh testified during his deposition that it was part of his concern. It was the debt that was the big part of the issue if Kent Stevens walks away. And it's also part of the reason that they didn't want to buy Kent Stevens out. It was because they didn't want to run this company. They didn't want to try to manage this debt. And so it did have a large part in this, and it was part of the negotiation process. Scott Keogh was essentially wearing two hats during this negotiation. One is the membership interest purchase, and then one is the financier of this company. And so I'll continue on what we have here.
Before you do that,
yes,
Mr. McIntosh, I want to go back to the formulation, the elements that we have for economic duress.
Yes, sir.
And for me, the simplest way to think about it is, one, the challenging party has to show their will was overborne, and two, they have to show really bad conduct. I mean, in real simple terms, that's how I would apply the test. So when you break those two things down, was their will overborne? Was the conduct really bad? Which of those are questions of law, and when does it become a question of fact in terms of saying, hey, this is for the jury to decide whether this person's will was overborne? What kind of facts do you have to show to get that threshold to get to a jury on if those are the elements,
sure,
that I'm looking at?
And I think those are a little different than what we have in Dunes Hospitality. And I'll just touch on that briefly. I'm going to get back to your question. And that's that there was some criticism of how this court construed the elements in Dunes Hospitality, that certain things are applied on a first element when it seems like they should go to the third element. But the reality is these things all overlap. When you're looking at involuntariness and you're looking at things like wrongful and oppressive conduct, and then in the third element you're looking at coercion and wrongful conduct, you're going to have overlap in those things. And so it is proper for summary judgment, to get back to your question, when there's undisputed material facts, and then as a matter of law you're entitled to judgment. And that's what Dunes Hospitality provides for us, is that Dunes Hospitality says if there is a legal remedy under these circumstances and you were aware of it, which we know you were because you considered terminating your affiliation or bringing suit, and then you brought suit, so you knew you had these options.
So you think that just ends it? If there are other remedies, regardless of how poor those remedies are, it's over. You lose. You don't get to go to a jury versus let the jury decide whether they think those are adequate.
You know, that's a difficult question to wrestle with, and I think the trial court explained that in its order was that in Dunes, in Pochett versus State Farm, and in Raspy versus Pillen, those are federal district court and the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, the remedy alone of bringing a lawsuit was sufficient to create a reasonable alternative. I think out of fairness, there has to be more to that. And the court says in Dunes that there are more factors that you have to look at, and those include things like the adequacy of the legal remedy. And that's really where the appellants hang their hat on this element, which is the second element, is to say that none of the other options were adequate. But what they're actually telling this court is that what they chose was what they said was economically efficient, was the page 14 of their reply brief. And so we have to be careful when we're analyzing what does it mean to be an adequate legal remedy. The citation in the appellant's brief cites to irreparable harm. Well, irreparable harm is one in which cannot be adequately measured or compensated by money. The typical remedy in that case is an injunction. The appellants have noted in a footnote in their briefs that they've abandoned their injunction claim, and that's because this is not the type of injury that is immeasurable or can't be compensated with money. The case that this court heard in McDowell 2018 SD1 was a really good example of what it looks like to have an irreparable injury. That was the historic district in Sioux Falls in which a home was built that did not conform to those requirements. And this court said the injury to the historic district was that this house isn't in conformity. There's no amount of money that can fix that. Also, the neighbors, they couldn't have their sunlight and they couldn't use their chimney. You can't measure that damage. It can't be $100,000 will then make that better because you'll never have sunlight again. That is an irreparable injury.
So within the Rule 56 standard, how can the court determine as a matter of law the adequacy of these options? And I think that's a big part of what Mr. Brentra is arguing. I mean, how is it that a court can do that? And what are your thoughts?
Yeah, so that gets us back to what does it mean when we're talking about adequacy of the legal remedy? If the remedy is you can bring a lawsuit, Dunes, Pochett, Raspy says that's sufficient for an alternative, a reasonable alternative. When we look at the adequacy of the legal remedy, we're talking about in a case where that might not be an appropriate remedy because you have an irreparable harm, one that can't be measured. In this case, there's no reason that the damages couldn't be measured.
So being judgment-proof is not an irreparable harm in your view?
Correct, Your Honor. And I think it's because that is getting it's starting to confuse adequacy of a remedy, having a remedy, and being able to collect. If you have a judgment, you can attempt to collect for 20 years. That shouldn't be an excuse. That doesn't make it unreasonable to not pursue that. You would still be able to have a remedy to pursue a judgment, and then you can make collection efforts. But to say we felt we were under economic duress because we don't know if we could have collected against Mr. Stevens or against his company, one, I think it's speculative. And then two, I think that it is also and not what the adequacy of a legal remedy is actually looking at.
Well, I suppose, I mean, sometimes those agreements, I mean, they themselves generate injunctive or equitable relief to keep the status quo. And there's some hint in the briefs that might have been a part of the relief. So judgment proof or not, that who knows, maybe that could have been part of it. But I want to bring up a topic that I mentioned with Mr. Brentra when I was visiting with him. And as I say, I don't mean to pick a nit, and I'm very willing to be corrected on this. But as I read everything, it seems as though the dynamite option was directly related to the price. And I began to think about this a little bit when I was reading Mr. Keogh's deposition, and there's an exchange that you had with him when he said, yeah, I mean, I guess I could have said no, or I could have walked away. And I'm paraphrasing, of course. What about that? And was the dynamite option, am I being too myopic, was the dynamite option broader than just the $100,000 price? And if I am, as I say, then I'll yield. Or is that an accurate characterization of the record? It was connected solely to the price, and there's really no evidence in the record that says Stevens told Keogh, you're going to leave or I'm blowing this thing up.
So I think your analysis is correct, although I think at the very end there it was a little bit different. So the dynamite option was, and that is their language to be clear, but we're accepting that for this purposes, that he was going to, they were going to accept his price point at $800,000, or he would walk away from the company, Kent Stevens being the he in that scenario. And if doing so meant that his crew would leave with him, which they probably would have because they were loyal to him and they worked with him day in and day out. And then in return, if the customers would have left with him because they worked with Kent Stevens and his crew, that would have left them in a position where they would have financially been in constraints. That was essentially the dynamite option. And the option that you were discussing is that Attorney John Mullen said, one of the options I provided them was to call his bluff and say, no, we're not selling you our option or right. our interest. And I think that's what you're getting to there. Is,
yes.
Yes, that was an option that they were provided, but it wasn't the economically efficient option, as they describe it, because they didn't want the company.
Right. But if the main element, the main coercive element, the only coercive element is this dynamite option, that didn't – is there any indication that that would have been used or applied to – that option of saying we're not selling at all, and that would have triggered, was there a concern that would have triggered Mr. Stevens' dynamite response if they would have said, okay, I mean, we're just not going to pay $100,000, we'll grind it out?
You know, it's not reflected in the record. You know, that wasn't presented, because what was presented from the appellants to Mr. Stevens and TCU was, we're going to accept your offer.
Well, the reason I ask is because that's fine. But the reason I ask is that in many of these cases, the Alaska case, the older one, I'm blanking on it right now, recounts a lot of these, you know, results and individual cases, and you can at least look at them to see how they illustrate principles. But it seems like many of them, maybe most, maybe all, kind of have this feature where the plaintiff is really in a tough spot. They have to, you know, they've got a claim for, it was the case where they took a ship from somewhere in the Gulf Coast all the way through, and they got stalled in California, and they needed money. And they compromised a couple $100,000 claim for much, much less because they had to have something. Then they needed to pay an obligation. There's another example where someone had to pay a mortgage, so they compromised a big claim for a small number. If I'm reading things here, Blueprint was going along just fine. Gulf Coast was okay. Aladdin, not a member, was getting paid. So does that assist in at all in this analysis as in terms of how we examine this under Rule 56?
Your Honor, I think it goes to the element of reasonableness of the alternatives. And the reason that it would apply there is because the appellants try to use it as a fact against us, in that they say that this company was starting to do well, so we should have gotten more money. But as you had demonstrated there, that means that the other options that were available would have also been reasonable, which would have included, if they truly believed that these things were possible, they could have triggered the buy-sell event by terminating him as the operations manager. That would have put them in control. They would have been controlling the price pursuant to the term in the operating agreement, which they also alleged that we violated by not using. They would have been in control. They could have set that price point. They could have bought out Kent Stevens, and then they could have used this company that was then being
private. That would have been worse than the diamond option in some ways, because that would have drove them away. So, I mean, I don't know about that one, but in any event, I understand your argument.
And yes.
Counsel, if I could just turn you briefly to Section 203 of the agreement.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you're arguing that operates as a release of claims. What language in 203 leads you to that conclusion, that this is a release as opposed to a seller's warranty or a representation of fact? Can you walk me through that?
Yes, Your Honor. The language in 203 is that, and it's captioned legal proceedings, and it's a two-part, and I'll finish answering this question. It says that there's no claim, action, suit, proceeding, or governmental action, parentheticals, action. And then it goes on to name a number of things, which I do believe would be more of the warranty type provision. But then at the end it says, no event or has occurred or circumstances exist that may give rise to or serve as a basis for any such action. And again, that's claim, action, or suit. And so our interpretation, and the one that it was accepted by the trial court, is that this is constitutes a release and waiver, because you have a person in a possession of a right who is doing something contradictory to that right. Here, if they believe they had this option to sue, they're saying in this representation that they signed, and it's undisputed they signed, that there was nothing that occurred. And nothing had occurred. There was no event that has occurred or the circumstances that exist that give rise to a lawsuit. And I think that that is clear and unambiguous language that they agreed to when they signed these agreements.
Thank you.
Thank you, Justice.
Can I ask one more? I know it seems like your focus on the Dunes factors are the first two, but I just want to ask you about the third, whether there was a coercive wrongful act. So is the operating manager's threat to violate a non-compete and go and start up, is that wrongful coercive conduct that would have satisfied that element?
Well, I think,
or at least left it open to a question of fact.
Justice Devaney, this is that is the toughest element out of the three for us, and I think the reason is because it is true that he was a manager, but he was an operations manager. I think it's also called the general manager. He is not the manager as it relates to the LLC formation, and so the statutory triggers, as they are referenced by the appellants, don't apply to Kent Stevens or to TCU. So the fiduciary duty specifically would not apply.
Does it have to be a fiduciary duty for it to be coercive wrongful conduct?
No, I don't think it does have to be. I think outside of the statutory duties, you may still have common law fiduciary duties that may apply in that scenario. But I think what the trial court illustrated, and for purposes of being quick here, the trial court went through each of those acts and those conducts and said what he was doing was simply what the law entitles him to do. Even though he's an operations manager, he had the right to quit that, just like the other two partners had the right to terminate him for cause.
Well, it's not just the quit. I think it's the non-compete.
And I think that I would point out that seems to be inferred from Attorney John Mullen in his testimony. He said he inferred that these were the things that were going to happen. And what the trial court spelled out was those may be the natural consequences of what happens if he goes and leaves and his customers follow and his crew falls. And then the fact that he was going to compete or potentially compete is completely speculative. There was no indication that that happened. And at the point that this document was executed, they were simply threats at that point. He hadn't actually done anything in that regard.
Thank you, Mr. McIntosh.
Thank you, Justices.
Mr. Brantford, you can proceed with rebuttal.
Address the true-up issue. Although John Mullen was negotiating that issue, it's still at the point in time when Scott Keogh is planning to fly out to Casper to negotiate the ultimate number. And so Scott would have been able to get a bigger number, accommodate whatever that true-up number is with his new number. And so the fact that they're negotiating is irrelevant to this because that's the point at which Scott's hands become tied. This idea that if you're aware of a legal remedy, that therefore you meet element two is absolutely false. You can bring a lawsuit, and none of the cases that we've cited, and not even Dunes itself, says a lawsuit. It says an adequate legal remedy. Not a legal remedy, an adequate legal remedy. I think when you get to paragraph 32 of Dunes, Justice Abers is essentially treating all of the conduct of all these members saying, yes, let's terminate their management contract. Yes, let's sue. No, don't sign this settlement agreement, as party admissions, that it was reasonable to do that. That's a different case, and it's so dangerous to treat the results there as if they're somehow the rule to be followed here. They're absolutely not.
So your view would be if there's evidence that Stevens may be judgment-proof, that's not an adequate remedy, legal remedy.
So there's a lot of factors that go into it. That's one of them. Another one is the irreparable harm that's going to happen by blowing up the company. You have a company that suddenly is going to have no customers, no employees, substantial debts, and will be a wounded shell of itself, perhaps forever. But that's the type of irreparable harm. The idea.
How about this debt that's out there for $3 million? Seems like that maybe cuts both ways in terms of, and maybe that's going to the last part about,
you know, how much duress or bad conduct there is. So Stevens effectively owes $3 million, or the company owes $3 million to a company that your client's affiliated with. And they obviously, if the company shuts down, that $3 million is going away. That may be a bigger deal than the $800,000.
Right.
How does that fit in? Does it fit into your
yes
your theory?
It does, and it's $5 million, not three.
Okay.
It was six in February. They pay it down to five by the time of the closing. And the interesting thing is, all of the members are personally, and all the owners are personally guaranteeing this debt, and so all of them are on the hook for it. Although Kent is on the hook for $20,000 minus his bankruptcy exemption, and so he's not. And so it's a huge threat. That's why it's such an incredible threat, is it's not just we're going to shut down the company. I'm going to shut down the company and leave you with $5 million worth of debt that you're all responsible for.
You know, that debt was hanging around for a long time, though. Right? It seems like the record's pretty clear in this regard that Blueprint was slow to start. The original $500,000 line of credit that Aladdin extended grew to big numbers, and at one time, as you say, over $6 million. So that wasn't new, and they weren't always great on debt. Blueprint wasn't, but they were getting better by the time of these negotiations. As you say, they were paying down millions of dollars.
Yes.
So they're doing it. So how is that coercive? How is these negotiations supporting some sort of inference of coercion?
It's not in isolation. When you factor in the idea that he's threatening to blow up the company so it can then create zero more revenue for the foreseeable future while all of these debts hang out there for which he's not responsible, that's the threat.
So Stevens didn't have to agree to take out the lender either, did he?
No, but he would need to continue paying it.
Right. And maybe he could have done that, but he didn't. Somewhere between the Mullins Ridgeway negotiations, part of the deal was, oh, and by the way, you're going to take out Aladdin as the lender. Didn't have to do that for the equity buyout.
Okay. But the purchase price then is still the wrong number. Even if that happens, even if somebody follows through on their responsibility, the purchase price is still a hostile act. But when you walk out the door of this courtroom into the rotunda, the four corners feature four statues, four bronze statues. Courage, vision, wisdom, and integrity. That last one is almost unusual. Integrity. Why would that be a cardinal virtue of this state? People have to stand by their word. People respond to situations by honoring their duty. People don't make threats like Kent did. This is an unusual case. He figured out what the pressure point was, which is that you've got $5 million worth of debt on the other side of this.
You need to wrap up, Mr.
And all he had to do was to continue making threats to blow the whole thing up. That's actionable under lots of different theories, including economic duress. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case is submitted. We'll be in recess.